Bros Pod is brought to you by Bet Online. Bet Online is back, better than ever. A new web interface for the rest of the NBA season and more props, odds, and lines than ever before. Bet Online remains your number one spot for all the basketball and football action this season. So head to the new updated desktop or mobile website to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Just use our promo code BLEAV50, that's BLEAV50, to receive your bonus. From basketball, football, NHL, boxing, and UFC, right to your favorite Vegas casino games, don't wait to take advantage of all the amazing offers available for the 2021 season. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet all your favorite sports. BetOnline, where the game starts.
Everybody, welcome to another version of Bill Roden on Sports, Bros Pod. I'm here at a real undisclosed location on Long Island, you know, getting ready to bring in the new year. I mean, Christmas with, you know, my family and friends, and here holding it down with my co-host and friend, the great Jamal Murphy. Murph, happy Merry Christmas, man. What's going on?
Yes, Merry Christmas. Great to be here, of course. I've been saying I had a long night last night while watching my wife wrap presents. So it's been it was a long one. I'm not good at that, so there's nothing I could do to help.
Well, you could have.
It would have been ugly, you know.
Convenient excuse. But so were the boys asleep? I mean, how did you guys?
Yeah. You got to wait for the boys to fall asleep and then get to work, you know.
All right. Well, good. Well, anyway, listen, man, speaking of holidays and specialties, we have a special guest, a longtime friend, an exceptional coach, somebody who basically is officially one of the pioneers of Black college basketball coaching, and talk about none other than the great Perry Clark, who's joining us from, I believe, South Carolina. Is that right, Perry?
Well, actually, I'm in the Washington, D.C. area today. This is home, and I came home to see some relatives and family, and I'm actually in D.C. today.
Oh, all right. And actually, early this month, you celebrated a birthday, right? You celebrated a birthday December 4th, celebrated your 35th, right?
That is correct.
Yeah, man. So anyway, no, Perry Clark, man. Perry and I go way back, man. In fact, Perry reconnected with me a couple months ago, but there was a point in time where we were talking all the time. And just to let you know, you know, Perry, like he said, he's from DC area. He's a player. You played at Gettysburg, right?
I played at Gettysburg. I played my high school ball at DeMatha.
DeMatha, coached at
DeMatha. And more people know me from DeMatha than they do Gettysburg, because I tell everybody, Gettysburg was more famous for the Civil War battle than for my playing.
Hey, man, well, you know, that's where you start off talking about, yeah, Roden, I heard you were a famous football player. And I said, you know, man, you know, we're in the same boat. In other words, we both had what they say, a good experience. Did you set any records at Gettysburg?
I was all conference, and I led the league in foul shooting one year, because coming from the math, you had to make fouls, else Morgan ran you to death. So, you know, we could do that pretty good. But I did not know that you were a big-time football player from Morgan State. And that's why I got to tell the fans, because I know when you first got started, and I was up in Baltimore recruiting, and nobody went into Dunbar. That was like sacred territory. The great Bob Wade ran that place like a tight ship, and you had free reign of the building, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. I didn't know who you were working for. I didn't know if you were with the CIA, the FBI, the NCAA. All I know was that you were treated with great respect, and you had the ability to talk to Reggie Williams, who was then the number one player in the country, and couldn't anybody else talk to him. So you automatically got my attention.
Then who is this guy? You know, and I was telling you before we got on air, the history is that, you know, before he was a legendary coach at Dunbar, you know, I went to Morgan State, and Bob Wade was a great player at Morgan State. He played defensive back on a lot of Morgan's glory teams, you know, those undefeated great Morgan teams. And I went to Morgan, and all those guys, a lot of guys who went to the pros would come back. And after my freshman year, it was decided I was going to switch from wide receiver because Morgan didn't really, we were 3 yards in a cloud of dust, and I was going to be defensive back. And so that spring practice, Bob Wade really helped me make the transition from wide receiver. He taught me basically how to backpedal, just how to play defensive back. And so I knew Bob from there, and, you know, I started 3 years at Morgan. And then, you know, Bob, you know, he finished his pro career. He had a great pro career. And then, you know, he turned in and it's such a thing, man. He started coaching basketball at Dunbar, and he became, there was a guy, I don't know if you knew him, Perry, you know, Sugar Cane.
Yes.
At Dunbar.
Yes.
Sugar Cane.
His team beat the Matha with Skip Honeycomb Wise by about 15, and Skip Wise had 47.
Wow.
And so that got our attention immediately in the D.C. area, because D.C. was supposed to be known for basketball. But, yeah, he did a tremendous job over there in Baltimore.
Yeah. So when you were recruiting, when did you first start recruiting? Well, let me just tell people, man. You know, we always have to let people know who they're listening to, know they're not Pharisees. You know, so let me just tell people, your coaching career stretched from 1975 until your retirement from University of South Carolina 2020, but you coached at DeMatha, your high school. You were an assistant coach at DeMatha, and then you were an assistant coach at Penn State. Then you were an assistant coach under Bobby Kremers, right? Georgia Tech.
Exactly. Yes. When I came there, they were wearing bags over their head. And and I went down there with Bobby. And I tell you a funny story. Roy Williams and I were really close. And when he heard that Georgia Tech was talking to me, he called me to talk me out of taking the job. He said, Perry, they're so bad. He said, we could have scored 100 against them. He said, in fact, they had one of their guys, Lou Grillo, at the time, Grazzo, and he scored a basket for North Carolina and all like that. But it was funny because he called to try to talk me out and scared the crap out of me, too. But I wound up taking the job, and I've never regretted it.
Right.
You guys turned around. Were you? Because you stayed there from 82 to 88. Now, right. Did you have Kenny Anderson in that group? Kenny Anderson, Dennis Scott?
I recruited all of Dennis Scott. I recruited Kenny. And I tell you, the story was, this was supposed to be the national championship. We were going to get Dennis Scott, Alonzo Mourning, and then get Kenny Anderson.
Right.
And I was involved in recruiting all of those guys. And the big fella kind of ruined the party with Alonzo. And you're a friend of mine, Big John. Just he put his foot down on that one. But I really thought that we were going to get Alonzo there too. And Bill, you know, you talk about doing these things and telling secrets. This was one of the secrets for recruiting. What Bobby, when they came in to visit Georgia Tech, and we had 5 ACC rookies of the year now, so it kind of worked. And we would bring them in, and Bobby would go to dinner with them on Friday. And then Saturday, I would take them to dinner with one player. And then after dinner, the team, the starters would come over, and we would sit in the restaurant, and everybody would sell the guy why they needed to come. So I'm sitting there with Mark Price, with Bruce Dalrymple, with John Sally, and all these key people, and we're banging Alonzo Mourning. And normally we crack them. I mean, it's like, you know, Price is telling him, I'm going to pass you the ball. Sally's saying, look, I'm going to help you and do all like this. So coaches couldn't come behind us and say, well, you don't want to play with that guy because he's a bum or he ain't going to pass you the ball. So we're all sitting there and get everything out. And then afterwards, I take them back to the hotel, do the final pitch. All right. And then after that, Sally and the guys would take them and they go out. And it was a wrap. I could not close Alonzo Mourning all the way back to the hotel. Bill, he never spoke to me. Wow. He didn't say a word. So I knew that that one was not going to fly. But that was supposed to be. So we got Dennis and we got Kenny. And they did wind up going to the Final Four. I had left, but that was, but they did take that group to the Final Four.
Yeah, now that was a great team.
Yeah. A great era for Georgia Tech. Like you mentioned, Mark Price. I kind of grew up on those guys, like Mark Price, John Sally, and then turning over to Kenny Anderson and Dennis Scott.
And then that was fun.
Yeah, that was a great team. And then you left. And you got your first head coaching job, right, at Tulane, where you learned your New Orleans accent. and you stayed out Tulane from 1989 to 2000. Then you became the head coach at Miami. That was in the Big East, right?
That was in the Big East. And
2004, you spent four seasons there. And then you went to Texas A&M, Corpus Christi, from 2007, 2011, and then you became the assistant coach, South Carolina, from 2013 to 2020. So you've had a phenomenal career, Perry, that ran from 1975 to 2020. Let's start from the and work backwards. Why did you finally decide that it was time? It was a wrap that you were going to, and who knows, I say retire, but who knows, you could end up
Right.
All this money they're throwing out there, you could end up somewhere else. But why did you wanted to do something different?
Well, it was a combination of things. It was, number one, it was COVID was hitting. Number two, I had planned on maybe a year after that to maybe step aside, but they didn't know if the season was going to happen or not. The other thing was, I thought Frank was looking, people were coming after Frank with different opportunities and everything. And he was listening. And I just didn't want to relocate and go to any place in the world. And so I wanted to kind of take my career in my own hands. And I felt like I was going to do some things in the NBA. I had done television in all of those gaps, and I could go back and do some television. And I did not really understand how bad COVID was going to shut everything down. So that kind of threw a curveball in it. But as I told people, I was stepping away from South Carolina, but I was not retiring from work. I've always been like a shark. I got to swim to live. And so I got to keep working. And so that's kind of what happened. And, I think there'll be some other opportunities out there. I think that I still love the game and follow the game, but it's been a fun career.
Yeah. It's just in turning out, and Jamal does another podcast thing called Up Next.
Yep.
Right. And they deal with a lot of high school kids, and they deal with, like, the high school and up and coming kids. How have the kids changed, and how has recruiting changed from when you first started doing recruiting, I guess, when you were at Penn State as an assistant, from the time you left South Carolina State? So you were recruiting young kids, these teenagers, from 1976 all the way to 2020. And how did the business change? I mean, was it the business change or you changed? How did it change?
Well, I think, first of all, back then, we could go out all the time. There were no real recruiting rules. I saw every one of Reggie Williams' games his senior year. Okay. And I didn't get him, but I wound up getting Dwayne Farrell, because everybody in Baltimore knew me and knew my persistence, and they liked me. And Dwayne was fairly easy recruit because he had seen me so much and spent so much time. He only spent about 10 years in the NBA. So, but I think the difference is the ability to touch the kids and to be able to go out and really form relationships. Now you're kind of on a time clock and you can only go certain times, and they handle it more like a business instead of forming relationships. And out of the relationships, you were able to get a pipeline of players, and you were able to get better players, we could get better players then than you can now. That's why it's very hard to crack that elite group. When we were at Georgia Tech, we cracked that elite group. Like I said, when I came in, they had bags on their head. When I left, we were preseason ranked number one in the country. You don't see that all happen very at all now, you know, and the blue bloods are the blue bloods because the way the rules are, it's very, very hard to establish or to crack that because you can't afford, you don't have time to get those kind of relationships. And I think the other thing was, it was the evolution of the black coach. I think you had the John Thompsons, you had John Chaney, you had Nolan Richardson. I mean, and these guys were able to attract a little bit like what Deion's doing now. They could get blue chip players and everything. And so therefore, as an assistant, you could play on that and you could come in and take responsibility for the not just the athletic growth, but the mental and academic growth of a young person and help place them. And what a better place to do it than Atlanta. I mean, you know, we had, you know, Andy Young was the mayor. I tell you a funny story. The ACC came in and ruled that Andy Young, the mayor of Atlanta, was considered an alumnus of Georgia Tech. And so therefore they banned him from being able to talk to our recruits. Wow. And I have to tell you, Bill, that only lasted about 2 days. And Andy being Andy, he picked up the phone. I don't know who he called, but he told him he was the mayor of Atlanta and he could talk to any darn body he wanted to talk to. And if they'd had a problem with it, go see his lawyer. And, you know, and they did away with that, you know, but it was just a really, really good and very, very special time, you know, at that point.
So, yeah. So how's it changed now? So you used to be able to have that access. So now you're saying you really can't build relationships?
It's very, very difficult to, because now, number one, you could deal, like moms and dads would tell you, coach my son, I will raise my son. Now what they have, moms and dads wants, especially dad wants to be their friend because they want to manage their career or they want to manage their money. And so what they're asking you to do is not just coach him, but also parent him. And that probably started around the early 2000s, where they wanted you to step in and you just had to act as parent as well as coach and put the discipline off the court as well as on the court. And so that was really, really a difference. I mean, I remember having to take guys' car keys because, you know, they were messing up in school and all. And then when I first started, mom and dad would step in and do that. You know, you call mom and dad and they would say, okay, you know, they would either show up or they would participate in that process. And I tell you, somebody now that has had great success doing it the old way is Leonard Hamilton, you know, at Florida State. I mean, Leonard is still very much old school with that. The parents are still very, very much involved. The families are still very, very much involved. And he connects with them in order to get the type of discipline and everything in the program. And that's why he's been able to get some of the players that he's gotten, because there's still parents that want that kind. They don't want you to be their buddy or their friend. They want you to be their coach, and they want you to have some real straight discipline, you know, with their kids over the program and everything. But, you know, I tease Leonard all the time. Leonard's the only guy that guys that he doesn't play are lottery picks.
Right.
I mean, I said, how can a guy be a lottery pick and you don't even start him? You know? So it's really changed, and social media has changed so much. I mean, you know, it's changed so much. I tell people, social media for kids is like looking at yourself in a cracked mirror and trying to figure out how good you look. And it's awful hard because the mirror is completely shattered and you're trying to walk away with an image of yourself that is just hard to be positive because the mirror's in so many pieces. And so I think that's what makes these kids so fragile the way they are now. Mm.
What role has AAU played? You know, everybody, you either demonize it or laud it. What role, how powerful was AAU when, you know, when you first went from being a high school assistant to Penn State? What you know, because I know that there was always, you probably went to five star. There was always five star. Yeah. And there was like, remember the guy, Chris, what's his name? Chris.
Chris Wallace.
And he's
a general manager now in the NBA.
Exactly. Remember, he had that
blue ribbon.
The blue ribbon.
Yeah, you know, he sold it out the trunk of his car.
Yeah, those things were great. I mean, those things were really sensational. But how did that evolve? You know, by the time you got in, was AAU, what we call AAU, just getting started? I mean, what? So just tell me the evolution of the conveyor belt.
Okay, Bill, I'm going to tell you exactly what happened with AAU. And any college coach that complains about it, you tell them you created it. Because here's what happened, okay? Guys that just were neighborhood guys that wanted to get players and give them some exposure got together. They were mailmen. They worked in the government. They had other jobs. And so they just got neighborhood kids together, and they went out and they started to compete and showed interest in the kids and everything. And then here's what happened, all right? Certain schools, and I'm not going to call names, but certain schools started paying AAU programs to come and play exhibition games for them to be able to attract their players. So, for example, you have your little AAU program there in Long Island, and all of a sudden Coach X says, look, we need an exhibition game, Bill. So now we're going to bring you and Jamal in, and we're going to pay you $175,000 to play this exhibition game against us, or $125,000. And that's not an exaggeration, all right? Or $50,000 or $60,000. And then all of a sudden, guys start saying, well, hell, you can make money in this AAU coaching thing. You play a couple of these exhibitions. Or they say, Jamal, I really like what you did on your zone press, all right? So I'm going to bring you to my camp, and I'm going to have you speak, and I'm going to pay you $30,000 to speak at my camp. Right. And so all of a sudden, people start saying, boy, I'm going to become an AAU coach. I'm going to do this. And then the great Sonny Vaccaro came in, and what he did was, if you ran a top flight program, then he gave you to operate your program a couple thousand, $100,000, you know, as much as $200,000 to run your program. All right. And so now guys, all of a sudden, that didn't have real lucrative jobs said, shoot, I can stop doing this. I can take this and I'm going to run my AAU program. And that's when AAU changed and it became an instrument of income as opposed to an instrument for development of young people. But it was created and started by the college coaches and how they tried to utilize it to change the landscape. Because here's what happened, Bill. All of a sudden, Black coaches were getting jobs. Myself, Wade Houston, Rudy Williams. I mean, we started getting Leonard Hamilton. We started getting jobs, and people got nervous at the fact that this was going on. And they tried to find a way to offset that. And one way to offset that was because we became points of differences. And in order to offset that, what they did was they walked in, and that's when they started going straight to the AAU guys and offering finances to come in and fill gaps on their exhibition games, on their camps, and things like that. And then that changed the scope of the AAU. I'm a big AAU guy. I'm a big proponent of it. It has helped a lot more kids than it has hurt. And but it got put in a different light when the financial rewards became evident in it that weren't there before. You weren't expecting that answer, were you, Bill?
Well, I always expect great answers, man. That was,
that was a great answer
for you to put it in a historical context.
Right.
You know.
Right. So you said so they got nervous. You're saying that other coaches got nervous because Black coaches were getting jobs. So they were nervous about Black coaches being able to recruit The black athletes.
Yes. Yes. And dominate the sport by their recruitment of the athletes. Mm-hmm. And so they look for alternative things, and that's when they locked into that. And basically, green outweighed black.
Right. And yeah. you think that's where we are now?
I think we're at an evolution of that. And I think, like, how many black coaches have gone to Final Four? I mean, how many black coaches are dominant when you look at the top 10? I mean, you know, and so, you know, something has changed. Okay. And I just think that it's no longer just because, you know, you're black. If John Thompson walked into a gym, everybody packed up their tent and went home. Okay. Right. I mean, because, you know, you weren't going, he did not lose. Now he picked his battle, but when he picked it, he didn't lose many. All right. And so, you know, Nolan, the same thing when he went to Arkansas and he rolled through there and got himself a national championship. I mean, you weren't beating my man in the South. I mean, you know, I was a coach and I was coaching against him and I was ready to go play for him. I mean, so, you just weren't going to be able to do that. So they got concerned about that. And so, you know, they negated it, you know, and I think now, it has been negated. I mean, I don't think that is as much of a cachet as it was back when I became a head coach in 88 and in the 90s. Mm. So, you know, that's...
You bring up a great point. But before I forget, I want to stay on this AAU thing. So what was the evolution of the AAU thing? And then with the big apparel companies, the shoe companies came in, which eventually landed some people in jail. How did we make that jump from, you know, the progression that you laid out, then the AAU, and then these, you know, what we call the sneaker and apparel company? How did that enter in, and what did that do to the business of recruitment?
Well, the great Sonny Vaccaro came in, and he set up a plan with Nike. And he first got it rolling because he labeled it grassroots. And he started to go to instead of the colleges, you know, because obviously the colleges couldn't take care of all the AAU guys and all like that. So what happened was, to be able to fund your programs, to be able to go out and get your best player, he wound up getting a niche of guys, maybe 10, 12 guys, all right, throughout the country. All right. And they kind of competed against each other with their budgets for the best players. And so they had the best players. And then he had it falling out with Nike. And then he wound up taking the same model over to Adidas. And he did the same thing in Adidas. And so, but it was the same formula. And so that, all of a sudden, those guys became Nike guys or Adidas guys. And then that's when the other shoe company, well, Sonny got Nike in, and then he turned around and got Adidas in, and then Under Armour came along and they had to get in. And the brand that started college basketball, Converse, was ridden right out of town. and you know, and they became a dinosaur. So that was the evolution of the shoe companies coming in. To help supposedly on the grassroots, which they did, to help in their development in the grassroots and everything. And all of a sudden you get a couple of stars and it was close. People don't realize that, you know, Adidas made a hard run for Michael Jordan, and they were very, very close to getting Michael Jordan, you know. And Gary Stokan was then at Adidas, and now he runs the Football Foundation. You know him, Bill. In Atlanta. Yeah. I mean, in all the major games that are in Atlanta are basically comes out of, you know, his foundation. And, you know, people see him as a football guy, but he was a huge basketball guy from Pittsburgh, you know, played it and coached at NC State and everything. But he when I first met him, he was with Converse. Then he went over to Adidas. But that's where the shoe companies came in, and they really leveraged the grassroots. And got in early with the kids, and then followed them throughout then latched on the colleges, and again, that Sonny Vaccaro that cut the first shoe company deal with colleges and everything, And, you know, now they become institutionalized and they got woven into the athletic system in the United States now.
Wow.
Say goodbye to dull gifts. Lightbox lab-grown diamonds are the brightest gift of the year. Using cutting-edge technology and innovative techniques, they've cracked the science of sparkle, creating the highest quality lab-grown diamonds you can find at a light price, $800 per carat. They have the same chemical makeup of natural diamonds, but just are grown in a lab. Because of their process, they can create stones in blush pink and beautiful blue, as well as a classic white. Lightbox lab-grown diamonds are the gift they'll never want to take off, priced so they won't have to. They really do make any outfit sparkle. Visit lightboxjewelry.com to add sparkle to your holiday shopping. That's lightboxjewelry.com. Lightbox diamonds, never a dull moment.
What I wanted to ask you before we got to that was if you were, and I think about this too, because we're both around the same age. And I keep thinking about now, if I was getting into the business now, and my assumption is that if you were, you know, if you were successful then, you'd be successful now. It's just the route would be different. So what do you think about what you would be doing if you were a young Black coach getting into the business now? Do you think it's harder? Do you think that it's easier? Do you think that the NBA and the pros make it better? How do you think that you would navigate the system now if you were, you know, a young guy now coming out?
Well, here's the thing. Certain pieces, like you, the vehicle may be a little different, but here's the constant, okay? Most of these kids, and you're around them as you're interviewing them all, they are frightened. They know what they want, but they don't know how to get it. And they're afraid and they're nervous that they won't get what they want. Most people, they're portrayed as being cocky or arrogant and all. And Bill, most of them are scared kids. All right. And they know what they want, but they don't know how to get it. And if you don't lie to them, and if you can show them a plan, a constructive plan of how they can get to where they want to go, I think you will always have an opportunity. That's why Deion getting the football guy, obviously he showed him a plan of how he could get him to where he wanted to get to, because most of them had no plan. And so I think that you have to be able to structure that. And it's the same thing that was structured before. It was just a different vehicle. If you came to Indiana, Bobby Knight was going to get you to be the best college player, you know, or Dean Smith or whatever. And you look at it now, okay, when a kid goes, think of it like this, okay, Kansas, Duke, Kentucky, North Carolina, when those places, that's like Oz, okay? And those guys that are there are like the Wizard. And if they come in to see the kid, a kid's going to visit because he wants to see the Wizard. And he wants the Wizard to touch him, and he wants the Wizard to give him a heart or courage or whatever so that he can finish his dream. And that's what they want. And that's why those programs always constantly get players, because the Wizard is there and they convince the kids that if you come to Oz, all your dreams will come true. And every kid winds up doing that, because who turns down a chance to go see the Wizard? All right. I love John Calipari, but he's the Wizard. All right. You come to Kentucky and something special is going to happen to you. All right. You go to Duke, something special is going to happen to you, all right? And every kid wants to pull that curtain and see that Wizard behind there. That's my analogy.
Mm. Right. So what did you think of the kid? You know, I wanted to ask you about the HBCU thing. You know, you mentioned Deion a few times. And, you know, he's at Jackson State and all that. But, you know, you had the kid McCourt Maker, you know, made headlines and went to Howard. There's a big part of me, I did go to an HBCU, but there's a big part of me that thinks that that train has left the station, you know, in terms of, you know, the HBCUs becoming an epicenter. I think what you got to do is just do your own thing, basically. But what do you think about that? Got Cool Maker going to Howard, and you know, people say, "Will this change the landscape?" You know, and you just mentioned the Wizard and all that. Sometimes it seems just such a steep mountain to climb that is, you know, it's like talking about wealth and the wealth gap in America. You know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think we're talking two different things. I don't think it'll change the landscape, but I do think that there'll be some anomalies that happen because of the individualism that certain kids have. I think that the NLI is going to have a factor. I think the fact that nobody's talking about getting a degree, you know, coaches are not coming in the house and selling a degree. Not, I shouldn't say coaches, 90% of the coaches, you know, I mean, my God, I mean, we got Duke now recruiting one and dones. So, right. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, you know, that was sacrilegious and right. everything. And so the educational piece, which it was part of that foundation, has kind of dissipated some, you know, and so I think that you're going to find some outliers that in the HBCUs that can wind up creating and competing. I mean, our good friend Tommy Amaker has found a way at Harvard to have an outlier because, I mean, he was right there on a couple of top 25 players, you know, and selling them on the idea that, look, you come to Harvard, you're going to probably go early. And what better to have on your resume to say, you know, you attended Harvard and be able to come back, you know, with the money you can make in the pros and be a Harvard graduate. I mean, and so, and that had a lot of traction and a lot of you know, the certain kids. So, you know, I do think that there is a changing landscape with that, but for the most part, and I think the way television has picked up through the social injustices that were done over the last year and a half, they've given more credence to the HBCUs. And Chris Paul has done, you know, a tremendous job of advocating that and everything. And for him to take his time and his energy to be able to do that is a very, very special thing. It should constantly be applauded. You know, so I, like I said, I think that there's certain things out there that could affect and create a change.
What do you think of this, Pat? The most recent hiring cycle, you know, they had the largest percentage of Black coaches ever fill spots for college basketball. It was over 50% compared to what it usually is, 10-15% of Black coaches hired. You know, what was your feeling about that? Do you think that can be sustained, or you think that was a blip because of George Floyd? What do you feel about that?
I think it's a different mechanism. I think when here's the thing people don't really understand. The initial Black hiring were done by presidents, not athletic directors. I was hired by the president at Tulane. John Thompson was hired by the president at Georgetown. John Chaney was hired by the president at Temple. It was not the athletic directors that made the hires. It was the presidents on the initial Black entree in the head coaching. I think now the athletic directors now are starting to finally step up and are making making those types of choices through, again, the search firms are the X variable that makes it difficult for, and has made it a steeper hill for Black coaches to have to climb. But I think that, I hope it's an upward trend. You know, only time will wind up telling. You know, John Thompson used to say, and Bill used to hear him say this all the time, baby, we're fashionable right now, so let's ride the wave, you know.
Absolutely.
And so I think right now we're fashionable, so let's ride the wave and see where it takes us. But, I mean, but that was John's always John saying, you know.
Yeah. Well, hey Perry, you know, we talk about your head coaching gigs at Tulane, Miami, Texas A&M. What was your, did you have any of those stand out, like your favorite gig And one, maybe another one is your most stressful.
Oh, a Tulane, obviously, it's hands down. People there, I still have real friends there. You know, coaches, a lot of times you come in and, you know, you really don't have like life friends. You know, people that are there to pat you on your back while you're there. And then when you leave, you know, then, you know, put another shirt on and, you know, but I love New Orleans. I've got some real friends there. Mark Morial, who's head of the Urban League, was the mayor when I was there. I mean, and College Temple, who was the first Black to play at LSU. And that's a story in and of itself. He's a marvelous, you talk about a success story. I mean, we still talk and communicate. I go back to the city, but I love Tulane. And the only reason I left, Bill, and let me tell you, I had a sweet job. If I tell you, I had a 7-year rollover. I was special assistant to the president. Wow. And I had, but what happened was my president retired. My athletic director, who was Kevin White at the time, and now he's the AD at Duke, and he just retired, was my AD. They both retired within a calendar year of each other. And so the job completely changed and people started coming in that basically wanted to do things their way, which they have a right to do. And the dynamics of the job changed, my importance changed, and I got scared and I overreacted and I left. And I left for a bad job because Miami did not have an athletic director. They had a guy in Paul D, who was the president's attorney and was an acting AD. And Miami, as it is proved, is a shark's tank athletically. And, you know, I did what he asked me to do. And then at the end of the day, I got punished for doing what he asked me to do.
Right.
And so, you know, but it was just different.
What were your marching orders at Miami?
He told me instead of going out, because again, the boosters were very much involved in a lot of things. There was a lot of posturing for who was going to be the next athletic director and everything. And he told me, don't go out. Like at Tulane, man, I would go out and visit with people, visit with the donors. I gave New Orleans when I was there the whole month of August. The whole month of May in the spring, I would go out and raise money and do that. And I liked it. He told me don't do any of that. Don't take any meetings without clearing it with him. And so basically, he told me just sit there, coach the team. Be conscious of that. And then all of a sudden, when people said, well, we don't see him at this and we don't see him at that, then I tell you a story. They had a homecoming parade and they asked me to be on the float. So I said, yes, obviously. So the float went about a quarter of a mile and then they had me get off the float and go with Larry Coker to a stand that was set up and do a pep rally, which I did, okay? Well, the float kept going. So now the people past that did not see me on the float. And so they claim that I did not come and I stood them up and I caught a lot of grief for that. And nobody stood up and said, well, he was there, but we had him do this. And so, and so that was the kind of miscommunication that I got caught up in. And that made it very difficult in my stay there to be able to do all the things that, you know, that I was trying to do.
Not to mention, I mean, at Tulane, I remember you were very successful there. I'm not sure Tulane has been relevant since.
They've not. If you look at all the records, our guys set them. We went to the tournament and everything, and they've not been to the tournament since. And it was very, very, and it just nice people, just a great environment. I mean, you know, that dome, and we would play in the dome sometimes, that place would be rocking. And our arena sat about 3,500 and they sold beer, Jamal. And so teams would come in. There was some nights I came out there, and the Cajuns were drunk now. They had been drinking since about 6 o'clock. And I knew it was no way in the world we were going to lose this game. It was just no way. And the other team is looking around and all. And what they would do after we scored our first basket, everybody would throw beads on the floor for Mardi Gras. And all, like, it was just an intimidating environment for us. And it was, I mean, I never had a feeling when I walked on the floor and I knew we were not going to lose, you know. I remember we played Louisville in there one year, and that was always our nemesis because Denny Crum, great coach, great program, and they were the evil empire, and that's who we all were trying to chase. And, you know, and he didn't have one of his better teams, but they were still good, and we wound up beating them by about 20 points in there. And it was just an awesome feeling and everything. And, you know, we played Coach Chaney there, and we wound up beating Coach Chaney by about 18, 19 in that place. It was an unbelievable environment.
Wow. And you won the Henry Iber Award in 92.
Yes. Yeah.
Just briefly, then after Miami, tell me about the gig at Texas A&M Corpus Christi. What was that like?
That was an interesting deal. Here's what I was told. And as you say, you know, we as coaches, we don't tell everything and all like this. I'm going to tell you, all right? I was told that I was doing television, had a really good television schedule. I was doing Fox. They had a show called ACC Sunday Night Hoops. And I was co-hosting that for 4 years or 3 years. I was doing ACC games, Big Ten games, and the broadcasting was going good. But I was told I would never get another college job from the broadcast group. I had to get back on the sidelines by about 2 or 3 ADs. And so I wound up taking a job at Corpus, and we were pretty good. The problem was, listen to this now, in 4 years, I had 5 ADs.
Wow.
And that just made it got to be where it was extremely frustrating. And, you know, I tried to step out of my contract after my 3rd year because there was 2 jobs I thought were going to come open and I was in position to get, and I didn't get them. And that was deflating. And so I tried to get out of it. And they told me that I had to pay a buyout, which I was not about to do, even though that they were constantly changing athletic directors and everything. I tell you how crazy it was. We went, this is stuff you can't make up. We went in front of the enforcement committee, and the NCAA rep turned in the athletic director. Wait a minute, I'm not finished now. The athletic director turned in the president. All right. And we're sitting there. And I'm saying, only in a B movie can you see some foolishness like this. And so, you know, and so needless to say, the athletic director got fired. The NCAA rep got fired. The athletic, the president stayed for about maybe 2 more years, then he retired. And so I just kind of wanted out. And so that's what happened there. But beautiful part of the world. Texas, a different part of the world. And all, but you know, we had pretty good teams, and but it just, the leadership was a little shaky.
What made you go back on, you know, get back on the bench with Frank Martin at South Carolina?
Because I always wanted to go to the Final Four,
And you did.
And I thought that Frank, that was the only thing I felt in my career that had eluded me, that coming in I wanted to do. You know, at Georgia Tech, when they went, I helped recruit that team, but I was not there to participate in it. And, you know, I can tell you some story that I don't know how much time we got, but we came close to Georgia Tech, and it didn't happen. And I felt like it gave me an opportunity. I missed coaching. Frank was great. And so that got me to come back in. And it was a fun ride, you know, and going to the Final Four was a magical journey. It was really, really special.
So, you know, as we kind of wind this down, we could do this for another hour, but it's Christmas Eve. And, you know, you got, you know, do you have children, grandchildren?
Yeah, I have two daughters and I have one granddaughter.
Oh, wow. That's great. That's great. That's a blessing, man. Yeah. So what do you want to do? You know, you've had a marvelous career and this sounds like a book to come and maybe made to a movie. But what do you want to do now? Have you satisfied the itch for coaching? When you look through the window, you know, say you're out of the house and you now look at the coaching through this window from the outside looking in, is it something you want to get back to? Is it like, are you glad you did it, but now you're ready to do something else?
I tell you what, it depends on where the sun is shining from. I mean, or if it's rain. I mean, I look at it, I still feel I have the energy. I could come back to coaching if it's the right situation, but I want to be a part of the evolution of the game of basketball. I think that there needs to be a guidance in there, both for the young people that participate in it. I think for the young coaches that are trying to walk that mile and do that. I think the administrative pieces, I think they need to hear the voice of experience, and I think they need to hear the voice of history, and I think they need to take in the cultural differences that make up the NCAA and not just try to paint it all with one brush. And I think that is what has got it in trouble today. And I've seen you on so many panels, Bill, and all like that, and I know that you've had a voice and saying that, and I think that's why they bring you in, because you know, you are an intellect and they need some intellect right now to help guide them through. I say this in all humility. I think one of the greatest musicians of all times is Quincy Jones. And I think Quincy Jones produces, he performs, he does TV, he does movies and made a fortune out of before people know you could do that. He brings people together. I think I have multiple abilities to do those things. I just, the right situation to bring out that part of my talent is what I'm talking about trying to do. I think what they try to do is limit us a lot of times, and they try to put us in a box. And it, because then we become very easy to describe, you know? Yeah. Like if I ask you, how do you describe Bill Roden? I mean, you would talk for an hour. You can't do that in one sentence, but they like to do that to you. So I think, am I a coach? Yes, I'm a coach. Am I a motivator? Yes, I'm a motivator. Am I a humanitarian? Yes, I'm a humanitarian. But I think I want to keep my fingerprints in college athletics and touching young people and development of coaches, development of the game, and figuring out ways to do that is what I'm looking to do right now.
Yeah, but go ahead, Jamal. Sorry.
You mentioned the evolution of the game. What's the evolution of the game as you see it? You mentioned even, you know, off the court, you got NIL, all these other things coming. How do you see the evolution of, you know, specifically the college game?
Like Jamal, let me tell you this, and I could get like roasted for this, and I don't know all the people that follow you, but analytics, mm-hmm. Okay. That's become a big thing, okay? Right. Well, what analytics does, it tells you how to play something that has happened.
Right.
Okay? What we did was we created the narrative and changed the narrative before it happened. When I went to Georgia Tech and they had bags on their head, we changed the narrative. We didn't try to study what you need to do, why this happened, and we threw that out and we changed the narrative by going out and having personal relationships with guys, with developing talent, growing talent, touching people. And we as Black folks, we have unique stories, we have unique backgrounds, and it's hard to put us under a calculator and expect us and say this is how we act. They tried that with the SAT and the ACT, and now those have become outdated because we don't, you can't judge us. You can't analyze us like that. And so I think as looking forward, finding a way of touching and developing our youth and getting the best out of them and putting them in positions so they can be successful by motivating, by teaching, by listening, by touching them, I think is more worthwhile than looking at what a guy's numbers are all the time and trying to define him strictly from that.
Yeah, no, that's great. It was like, I guess it's been a great Perry Clark philosopher, coach, motivator. But clearly you have a lot more to offer. And as I was hearing you describe this, you almost have to, you're looking to almost create something, you know, that would take everything you've accomplished, everything you know, the wisdom, the connections, the contact, knowledge of the game, and put all this together and either create a position or be part of a program that wants you to play a role. Kind of, you talk about the wizard, you want to be Merlin, you know, you want to be the Black Merlin, you know. And so it is really intriguing to kind of, you've been in the media, you've done play by play, you've been in the inside, you've been on the trail, you've been recruiting, you know, you've been in so many aspects of the game. And it is like you're like an alchemist where you want to put all this together. And I think sometimes the difference between Black coach, white coach, if you are a white coach or a white person, then, you know, whether they say, oh, we've invented analytics, you can fit into this slot. This because, you know, they're kind of inventing stuff for themselves, you know. Right. And that's what they did. Well, we're going to invent something, and right. We're going to be the CEOs of it.
Right.
And it's harder for us to do that. But that would be, whatever that is, would be a perfect, you know, position. And hopefully, one of the things that sparked this conversation that you were saying that back in the day, you know, you would sit at the table and listen to Chaney and Big John and Nolan. And there was a natural handing the baton or handing information. And we would meet at the Fair Four and those kind of things. And we really, I don't know if that vehicle exists anymore, but it definitely should.
No, because guys like you and Wilbon making all the money, y'all ain't got time to do all that stuff. That's what it is. I mean, you know, but
Wilbon can speak that stuff. Wilbon and Stephen A. There's a whole other generation of guys who are thinking it out. But definitely, it would be great if that kind of thing could be recreated in a way that makes sense in 2021.
It would. Some sort of form and all. That in fact, in all honesty, that's something probably the NCAA should work to try to do in the sponsor, because I think that it would create tremendous growth for the sport, period. Yeah. And it's something that's needed, because there's a lot of mistrust right now that is going on. And here's the other thing, Bill, and this is sacrilegious. The money's gotten too big. It's really gotten a long way from what we thought it would ever be when we first started doing this thing. Maybe not you, because you always had those grandiose plans and all like that. But I mean, it has really, really grown.
It goes back to what you said earlier in terms of how they were able to combat, you know, Big John and you know, from dominating recruiting wise, you know, they were able to put money in it, which changed the game. So, and that's kind of where we're at now.
Yeah.
Without question, I mean, the NLI is a game changer. I mean, and here's the thing, you know, here's the thing. Can you imagine if Harvard could do NLIs and with their resources? Can you imagine what Zuckerberg would play for a front line at Harvard? Huh? He would put them all out of business, huh? How about that?
Yeah, very true. Hey, be careful now. You know, Harvard might take over.
But you know, Harvard wanted to, that's what they wanted to do, they did. Trust me.
Right.
You know, if they decide that's what we want to do, we want to dominate college basketball, or we want to create quarterbacks, you know, they do. Hey, Perry, listen, man, this has been more than we could have hoped for. This great conversation. This should be part one.
Yeah, we got to do it again.
But you know, I'm sure Perry will have his podcast next. You know, where he could have hold. You know, you could have these kind of discussions on your own, Perry, and with all the people you know, all the coaches, all the athletes, all the players, all the people you know. You could do a fascinating podcast, particularly if you're willing to tell all the secrets. You know, you know,
and burn, like, you burn know, all the bridges.
No, but here's what I've learned. Here's what I've learned from writers. You know, all about vocabulary. You can share information, but it's how you do it, and that's the bridge. You know, and Bill, you have conquered that bridge very, very well. I told you, man, the first time I saw you, I didn't know who you were working for. I said, this guy got John Thompson talking to him and Bob Wade talking to him. He must be in the FBI. He must be with the IRS. I said, he's got something going on.
Hey, listen, Perry, we got to do this again, man. But
I look forward to it. No, have a wonderful Christmas. Jamal, nice talking to you. And I'm going to circle back.
Really appreciate it.
Perry Clark, in 47 years in the business and still looking for the next level. So, hey, Perry, thanks so much, man. Have a Merry Christmas, a great new year, and look forward to seeing you on the big stage, another big stage.
Yep.
All righty. You guys take care now.
You too. Perry,
take care, man. That's great. The great Perry Clark. So that was a great conversation, Jamal. So before we let the people go, why don't you tell them how to, if they want to hear more conversations like this, they should subscribe. And
yes, definitely subscribe to the podcast so you get it directly to your phone. And you can listen to us wherever you listen to your podcasts, either Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, etc. Of course, we're also brought to you by Bet Online and also on social media. Check us out, follow us at Bros Pod on Twitter and at Bros Pod on Instagram.
All right. For all those people out there, wishing you a tremendous Christmas, a very happy and healthy New Year's. Remember, we keep reminding you, man, you know, I know everybody's traveling and doing, you know, running about, but, you know, this is a different time. And, you know, this is definitely the new normal. So just be very, very, very careful. Stay careful and, you know, try to just do the safe thing. Because we want you to hear us.
Exactly. All for selfish reasons, you know. Stay safe. Stay safe. You know, keep yourself safe. Keep me safe. How about that?
That's right. That's right. Wear those masks. Exactly. If you haven't been vaccinated, get the booster.
Get the booster.
Vaccinated. All that stuff is good.
Yeah, the booster's saving people out here.
Yeah, like the vaccination is like your armor. You know, it's armor. You know, so put that armor on. Be a superhero. All right. Hey, Jamal, listen, man. Merry Christmas. Been a great, 2021. It's definitely been different.
Definitely different. Definitely different. And you're right. We're closing in on the end of the year. I think we all thought 2021 would probably be a little better year than it was. And I guess it was slightly better than 2020. But here's to 2022. Being that year we were hoping for the past couple of years.
Yeah. Each chapter gets better. So, all right, everybody, stay safe, keep praying, and God bless. See you next week.